Before many of us started to think of Afghanistan as a lost cause, we all talked about it as the good war, that is, the war that we had a right to be fighting, for all sorts of different reasons. But the problem was, we had too many different reasons. Of course, we were there to fight against Al-Qaeda, or maybe it was the Taliban, or maybe it was Pakistan. We were certainly fighting for women's rights, or maybe it was actually to kill the heroin trade. We were over there to rebuild a broken society in some parts of the country, but in other parts of the country, we were okay with that, and we were there mostly to rebuild roads and bridges and dams and so on and so on and so on. Each different reason, championed by a different country or a different organization, from the UN to NATO to the World Bank, from the US to the Netherlands to Australia. The only people not calling the shots in Afghanistan, it seems, were the Afghans. Jack Fairweather reported on that chaotic playground of Western intentions for the Daily Telegraph and the Washington Post, and he wove a remarkable amount of on-the-ground reporting into his book, The Good War, Why We Couldn't Win the War or the Peace in Afghanistan, published by Basic Books. It's an example of how great reporting leads to unusual insights. Welcome to this episode of the Lionel Gelber Podcast. We're chatting with five authors whose works are shortlisted for the 2015 Lionel Gelber Prize for Best Book in International Relations. The prize is sponsored by the Lionel Gelber Foundation and the Monk School of Global Affairs in the University of Toronto in partnership with Foreign Policy Magazine. I'm Rob Steiner. Jack Fairweather is currently a Middle East editor and correspondent for Bloomberg News. He joins me from Istanbul. Jack, welcome.
Good evening.
So I wanted to get into this just by asking, there have been so many books on Afghanistan. In fact, a number of books written by some of the principals that you mention in your book. What makes your book different, if you will?
Well, I think history is a constant act of reinterpretation. And one thing that struck me as I was preparing to write the book, looking at the literature, was just how much of it was dominated by this one idea that affected both writers as well as policymakers and generals and politicians, and that was, if only we had given more resources, more men, more money to Afghanistan early in the war, things could have been completely different. And this is a notion that I was coming to sort of in light of the big U.S. surge of 2009, in light of the steadily deteriorating situation in Iraq, and felt like a perfect moment to change the narrative, reassess what we thought we knew, and really sort of go back to basics with the war and ask, really, you know, was more Western effort, was more Western attention the missing ingredient, or was there some other way forward?
Well, it almost sounds like as you read the book, and this is a theme that comes sort of right between your eyes very early on, that if there was a missing ingredient in the war in Afghanistan, it was the Afghans that we, when the West ever had a chance to include them in discussions about economic development or military strategy or ethnic strategies or anything like that, they were either completely forgotten or just, you know, left out of the room. Why did we make that mistake over and over and over again?
There were some truly dumbfounding moments. I mean, at the UN Donors Conference in 2001 in Tokyo, to all of the major international agencies had gathered. Everyone, in fact, except for the finance minister to be, Ashraf Ghani, who didn't attend. He had a simple request: could I have $250 million to pay civil servants, pay doctors, nurses, policemen, and to keep the state ticking over? And he didn't get that money. Instead, the UN got $1.9 billion over the next 5 years. And there's a huge gap between the spending of that money and it actually having a positive effect on the ground. And to get to the nub of your question, I think, you know, one of the problems is that we really read Western practices, Western experience onto Afghanistan, and instead of listening to Afghans, it was much easier to keep these giant aid machines going in their own sort of self-justifying loop. And very keen to write about how and why we should have listened to Afghans sooner, Afghans like Ashraf Ghani.
Was it? I mean, I almost want to ask, was it deliberate? Were there a set of deliberate decisions to not have Afghans in the room because, I don't know, we don't trust them or they don't get what we're doing? Or was it just an oversight like, sorry, we forgot to send invitation to the Afghans because we go around with our usual suspects of people from the World Bank, the UN, and they're not usually in these meetings?
We were coming at it with a formula in mind from the 90s with Balkans peacekeeping, where the West had formed several new nations out of the remains of Yugoslavia, and it was that sort of top-down approach that was brought to Afghanistan, this idea that you nation build, you create institutions, you staff them with technocrats, and then you have a country. And that was, very blind to Afghanistan's history as a country, the fact that despite so many years of war, it still had functioning ministries, albeit with very limited reach. And of course, the very decentralized and in many ways ad hoc ways in which Afghanistan works. 80% of the country still lives, still lives in agricultural, rural settings, still deeply tribal and conservative. And instead of scaling back our ambitions and keeping them minimal, the West grew as the war proceeded. And when you had Afghans advocating less is more, a slightly stripped down approach, those often didn't fit with the priorities of large donors. I mean, Western aid agencies like to showcase what they're doing in order to justify their budgets. It sort of comes down to that in the end. One of the senior British officials who worked for the UN upon the first sort of pre-donor meeting in 2001 said, "Great, now we've got another war to keep to keep us funded for the next 10 years." So that was somewhat the spirit, and of course, not always cynical, often very idealistic, but not necessarily grounded in what Afghans wanted.
The Balkan comparison is a very interesting one, and you draw that out a couple of points. In many cases, exactly the same characters, including Richard Holbrook, sort of picked up their careers from the Balkans, where they'd had some kind of limited success, and moved it over to Afghanistan. But it leaves an underlying question, which you don't really address in the book, and I don't know how closely you were watching the Balkan Wars when they were happening, but were Balkans themselves, Serbs, Croatians, Bosnians, Kosovars, were they more involved in the planning for their post-war countries than Afghans were? I'm wondering if there was. Well, I'll just put that question to you.
I didn't cover the Balkans wars so thoroughly, but what I think I can say from talking to those diplomats and aid workers who worked in the Balkans was there was this sense that everything from justice ministries to finance ministries to constitutions to police forces were being built from to some extent from scratch, and that same sort of ethos was brought to Afghanistan with the result that what there was of local indigenous networks were often bypassed, certainly when it came to the Afghan government. And that leaves completely ignores the fact that there were also these tribal networks that President Karzai was deeply tapped into, and which the West sought to thwart him at almost every step of the way as he sought to massage those tribal connections and forge a sort of traditional style of governance.
And this notion that we sort of misapplied rules from the last war, which is one of the constants of history, I suppose, right, into Afghanistan, right, has its place, as you're describing it, in all the political efforts around building the state. And then on the military side, too, you point out that David Petraeus came with a counterinsurgency notion, which had sort of succeeded in Iraq, sort of, and became the orthodoxy in the U.S. military, and tried to apply it on the ground. Afghanistan also blew up.
It was, and I think as has become clear that whilst the surge in Iraq led by Petraeus thought a sort of transitory peace. It didn't stand for much if you don't have a political framework in place. And what was, you know, very striking about the build-up to the surge in Afghanistan that sought to, you know, really militarize the country, pump out tens of thousands of Afghan troops, 100,000 troops. There's a tripling of the war effort in a little more than a year. What was not taken into account was how any of this was going to translate into a sustainable peace process, into a model that the Afghans themselves could run and indeed wanted to run. I mean, Karzai himself, the president, was saying, "Don't surge," and that was ignored by the military in an entirely vain hope that once they sort of got the whole machine going, that everything would fall into place. And it does beg a belief when you think about the Soviet experience, even the British experience back in the day, and to think that a giant Western-imposed peace could be the solution to Afghanistan.
Could actually work. Now, at the beginning of the book, you go through a number of, and you almost label them that clearly, a number of moments, lost moments. We could have turned it around at this moment, at that moment, at that moment, at that moment. What was the last moment, do you figure, when we actually could have turned this around and created something sustainable in Afghanistan? I mean, I'm almost assuming now that Afghanistan is a lost cause. I'm not quite sure I want to do that. We'll get to your conclusions in a second. But clearly we went down a very bad path. What was the last moment when we could have turned that around?
That's a very penetrative question. There's one moment that quite early on when I think the war's trajectory shifted and a lot else besides, that was when an extraordinary day in which Hamid Karzai had narrowly survived a friendly fire incident in which US military, who were guarding him as he sought to raise a tribal uprising in the south against the Taliban, that U.S. military escort called in a U.S. airstrike that landed right on top of their own positions, killing a lot of Karzai's men and some U.S. special forces and narrowly missing Karzai. 50 minutes later, he got a phone call from the Bonn conference saying, by the way, you've just been selected as the new leader of Afghanistan. And then that very evening, a Taliban delegation showed up with a letter from Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, saying, okay, we're ready to surrender. And
it's amazing, the Taliban ready to surrender the day that Karzai becomes the president. Holy smokes, right?
Exactly. And they sat down, they broke bread, they had tea, they discussed ministerial, post-ministerial perks for ex-Taliban ministers, how many cars they would have, what sort of security force that they would have. And, it was a moment of, happily positive missed opportunities. That is, the bomb hadn't struck. And yet here was also this great gilt-edged opportunity from the Taliban. And it was taken up the, it was passed on to Karzai's U.S. military support and fed up the command chain, ultimate to Rumsfeld, who sadly saw the war through that prism of you're either with us, against us. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda were the same in that sort of matrix, and it was quashed. No surrender for the Taliban, no sort of amnesty for ex-leaders. And with that, those Taliban ministers fled to Pakistan, and I think a real moment was lost. Not just the actual the deal itself that seemed to be on the cards that day, but really this sort of recognition across the country that the Taliban's ideology had been defeated. That there was a sense of real change and optimism among Afghans for something different. And it was important to send the right messages to show that, the future of Afghanistan was going to be one that brought together all sides, that there would be, if not a sort of truth and reconciliation commission, then at least something to recognize, you know, what had led so much of the country into civil war and strife over the last 30 years. And just as we did in Iraq when the U.S. chose to antagonize and persecute Sunnis who had worked in Saddam Hussein's regime, a similar process took place in Afghanistan whereby the Pashtun tribes of the south, the majority of the country, began to feel that they were being targeted and not, you know, brought into government. And, you know, right there is the political solution that we've been struggling to get back to ever since.
And as I read the book, I started to ask myself this question, which I sort of felt, I realized that I'd never even been allowed, or I'd never allowed myself to ask this question before. You know, the Taliban have become synonymous with the worst evil that the Western world can even imagine, a group of people that you don't negotiate anything with, et cetera, et cetera. And I start to ask myself the question as I read through the book, and particularly these passages, do we simply misunderstand the Taliban? Which almost sounds crazy. It's almost like, in my mind, like asking, do we misunderstand Nazis? Did we actually misunderstand the Taliban? Is there something there we should have known about them that could have helped?
I think understanding the way in which so much of their support was embedded in Pashtun tribal life, and the fact that, you know, the Taliban real appeal wasn't to Al-Qaeda style global jihad, it was to the sort of tribal mores of the majority who live in villages and country towns across Afghanistan. And that this network of tribes that the Taliban brought together needed to be spoken to, needed to be engaged with, and needed to be brought together. And, you know, the way to do that wasn't through armed confrontation. It seems almost ridiculous to say it. I mean, it's not so obvious, but rather through, you know, bringing together sides to talk. And that one of, you know, just one of these lovely, elegant, simple moments happened in 2005. A young Australian diplomat who I write about sent to southeastern Afghanistan to an area dominated by Jalal ad-Din Haqqani, who was a very feared opponent thought to be sheltering Al-Qaeda erroneously, it seems, at least from that 2001 period. Haqqani was sort of ruling the roost there and fighting with the U.S. forces. And Tom Gregg was, this young Australian, was simply said, you know, let's talk to him. Went to his brother's house in Kabul, knocked on the door one frosty night and said, look, you know, we want to develop, you know, we want to calm things down, develop some, you know, ties, build some schools. What do you say? And it was a pretty frosty meeting at first because Kani's brother had been detained and very possibly tortured by U.S. forces. But by the end of the evening, they, you know, the tea was eventually brought out, signaling a certain acceptance of Tom Gregg's presence. And that was the beginning of a year, at least, of real negotiation with someone who for years was seen as an absolute diehard, you know, supporter of the Taliban and enemy of the Karzai government. And, you know, those moments happened, you know, all too often, and were all too often ignored.
Shut down.
I think one of the things in the book I wanted to do was just, you know, sort of capture these diplomats and officers and Afghans who, you know, who were working towards this sort of political solution. And in a way, I found it encouraging that, you know, that there was this vision that many people found separately and tried to build on, in the sense that, you know, the future of Afghanistan, that's where it lies.
Yeah.
You know, the the giant military buildup is over, that to these, you know, simpler, sort of more subtler approaches yeah. that we need to turn to now.
You now, you're in Istanbul, you cover the Middle East, so you're out of that Afghan region, but you're also watching a whole number of very complicated conflicts happening just in your backyard. Do you see us repeating some of the same mistakes?
Well, I think you have to take the lens back and see a broader historical pattern. I mean, there's no question that the U.S. forces are going to be deployed in Syria, in Iraq, in the same way as they were in, you know, 10 years before. That sort of boots on the ground approach is over for the time being, and we've hit upon a strategy of containment. And it seems very similar to what happened after Vietnam, and when an approach of sort of covert wars was adopted as a means to sort of avoid that, you know, the disaster that was Vietnam. And you know, my concern is that somewhat takes off the table a lot of some of the overt measures to resolve conflict that are needed. You know, it's conspicuous how little you hear about peace talks and peace processes in Afghanistan and really in Iraq currently. And we're settling for a policy of drone strikes and covert war that will do very little to really address the fundamental causes of the conflicts that are going on at the moment. But that's so I see some of, you know, some mistakes and echoes as we try and learn from the lessons of one conflict, and sadly it seems repeat past errors at the same time. It's murky. I mean, the one thing I would say is it's positive that we're not charging into Syria and Iraq, but I don't feel that enough is being done on the political front to bring sides together.
Jack Fairweather is author of The Good War from Basic Books. Jack, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
If you'd like to hear more from the Lionel Gelber podcast series, we have discussions with 5 leading authors on international affairs this year, along with more than 25 others from the last 3 years. You can find them all on iTunes by searching for Lionel Gelber, that's G-E-L-B-E-R, or online at monkschool.utoronto.ca/Gelber. I'm Rob Steiner, director of the Monk School's Fellowship in Global Journalism. Thank you for joining us.